Okay, school is in session. Let's see. First, I wanted to say that I know you're there because every week I have to certify who's here for attendance. So I get to go through the whole roster. So even if I don't say hello to you every week, I say hello to you in my mind because I know that you're here. And so if I don't, if I haven't met you, please come up and say hello. That way I'll be able to attach the name and the face. So that when I go through the roster, I'll know who it is that I'm certifying was here this week. Also, if you come a little early, you might want to say hello to the people around you so you get to know who else is in this community. This is a remarkable group of people. As I get to know people, I feel how remarkable it is, or we are. So get to know other people in the class if you choose. A couple of announcements. First, please remember that on our last class on November 9th, there's going to be an art fair. That is, bring your artwork and put it around the room, and before class and at the close of class, we'll get to look at it. So please, be bold and bring something that you created. It'd be nice if everybody brought something. It's been pretty much fun when we've done it in the past. Is Donna here? Donna, are you here? Okay.
For the life stories.
Okay, so life stories. Oh, I guess I'll do this. This is the life story book. People have people who have been in this class have written something about their life, the life story and a synopsis for a page or two, or something about their life or an incident from their life, and they put a copy in this book, and a copy has gone to swt.org/Spencer. where you can find all the life stories if you want to look at them not using the book. So anybody who wants to borrow this book can take it home. I'll put it right here. So anybody who wants to borrow that, you can borrow it. And if you would like to contribute something to the life stories book, which would be lovely if everybody put a little something, even a poem or just a snippet from your life, if you do that, give a copy to Robert, and then I guess you can put it in and give it to Donna, and she'll put it in the book. Okay. All right, so life stories. Christine, where are you, Christine? And about this far away.
Hi, I'm Christina Kramer. And I wanted to let you know that two beautiful events that I have coming up in October. One is a seminar on angels. I've been connected with angels since I was a little girl. And many years ago, I was guided to create this workshop to help people learn how to directly connect with angels. There's a lot of beautiful meditations, guided imagery. We'll be working with the chakras. We'll be bringing in the archangels who work with your chakras. And many people who have come have had profound healing experiences. Somebody came with AIDS, and his diagnosis changed right after the workshop. It was very profound. And then I also am a channel for Mother Mary. And I give large group events here in Santa Barbara. And this is just all about opening the heart and love. There's beautiful healing energy that is transmitted from Mother Mary for me. And just right in the group, some people have spontaneous healings. You can go onto my website. I have flyers and a business card on the table. You can read about some of the amazing testimonials that people have experienced through Mother Mary's love. So the next topic that Mary will be speaking on is divine guidance. And everyone receives an individual healing and blessing. Thank you.
What is your website?
My website is Christina, C-H-R-I-S-T-I-N-A, Maria, M-A-R-I-A, Kramer, K-R-A-M-E-R.com. Thank you.
Thank you, Christina.
One further announcement, and then we'll sit. We're going to be talking about missing experience today, and we're going to be talking in this class about some extraordinary areas of our consciousness that we don't always visit, but that, as William James said, are separated from the rest of our consciousness by the filmiest of screens. So there are states of consciousness that he said that you can't close your accounts with reality unless you realize these states of consciousness are very potential in you and very close to your conscious, usual conscious ability. So if you're interested, what is it?
Well,
we'll talk about next week. I don't know. I have a lot of ideas, but it just puts itself together, really. I just do what it tells me, you know, kind of. I just know week to week what seems to be next. It's really the way I do it. It all kind of has an integrity that hangs together. It all is it's a continuous argument, but I don't know about that argument until it completes itself. I just kind of take the next step, the next step, the next step. And that process takes a lot of trust, but it has been remarkably successful. Anyway, if you're interested in visiting some of these states of consciousness that are potential in you, and you want to do so in a way that doesn't involve hooking down a major chemical, or starving yourself to death, or whirling for 10 hours, or doing one of the other things that, or having a near-death experience, you know, doing one of the other things that people do to access these states, well, there's a guy sitting here named Peter Wright, who is that gentleman right there, who his work that he has been doing for many years, that he is exquisitely expert at, has to do with taking people putting them in trance and giving people hypnotic openings to various profound states of consciousness. And this is just chapter and verse for him. I've talked to him a whole bunch and read stuff that he's written, and he's a master at it. And so if you want to experience some of this stuff we're talking about very directly, in a very safe, guided way, the resource is sitting right here, okay? So talk to Peter Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T. I should have mentioned that at the first class, but it didn't occur to me.
When did he speak at first?
I don't know, that's a good question, Julie. Well, that's a question for my contemplation. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about mindfulness, and we'll sit. What we're going today is we're going to talk about mystic experience, okay? Real, full-blown mystic experience. So I have to kind of set this up given what we already know. So when we look at mindfulness, this diagram that you're all, at this point, quite familiar with, we see that there are two ways that we can use our brain. There are two different needs situated at different places in the nervous system. The usual me, thoughts, feelings, and sensations, that's primarily situated in the top of the brain. Oh, I have to make you a diagram of the brain. There's my diagram of the brain. Okay, this is your spinal cord. At the top of your spinal cord is the brain stem. Above the brain stem is the hind brain, the lowest areas in the brain. Above that is the limbic system in the middle of your brain. It has to do with motivation and emotion. And above that, at the top of your brain, is the cerebral cortex. It has to do with thinking, the way we usually think of thinking. So, spinal cord, brain stem, hind brain, limbic system, cerebral cortex. What we're usually conscious of is the functioning of the limbic system, that is the hippocampus and amygdala primarily in the middle of the brain, and the cerebral cortex at the top of the brain. So when we say I'm having a thought or having a feeling, we're attending to what's happening in the top and middle of the brain. What happens when we shift our attention to our breathing? That shifting, by the way, is a top brain function. The shifting happens from the prefrontal cortex. That's what kind of controls where attention goes. So if I decide to shift my attention, I'm still using the top of my brain. But once I find my breathing, take a step back from the usual stuff that I'm involved in or immersed in, and instead just breathe and open and notice these things going through my awareness, then I'm operating from deeper in my brain or lower in my brain. I'm operating from the hind brain and the brain stem. More specifically, awareness seems to come from the pons and the reticular activating system, which are structures low in the brain, in the brain stem and the hind brain. So this is the top of and middle of the brain. This is the bottom of the brain, if you will. And we can move back and forth between these two ways of operating. And they're different ways of operating. The question is, does your awareness start with, is it generated by the structures low in your brain, the pons and the reticular activating system? And most people, including Michael Pollan, who we're going to look at in detail this morning, think so. Okay, that is, most of us believe that our consciousness is produced by our brain. And the ability to be aware is produced by the bottom of the brain, and then the stuff that happens in our awareness is produced by the middle and the top of the brain. Are you following me so far? This is as technical as I'm going to get this morning. So most of us believe that when you're asleep, there's no consciousness, and then when you wake up, there's awareness, and then in the awareness, there are these things that are happening. But that the brain is producing consciousness. And when you die, there won't be any consciousness because the brain won't be working. That's the way that neuroscience currently looks at it. That's the way that most orthodox scientists look at it. That's the way Michael Pollan, those of you who are reading his book, looks at it. But there is an alternative possibility, which is that the brain is not generating consciousness, it is transducing it. It's receiving it from outside and it's putting it into a form that the middle of the top of your brain can understand. It's reducing consciousness to the level of consciousness that is then useful to you to survive and thrive. So the brain is not the originator of consciousness, it's the receiver of consciousness. The analogy for this, so this sounds kind of far-fetched and woo-woo, except that, and you've heard me say this analogy so many times, but I'll do it one more time, which is that if you didn't know anything about a television set, you would turn it on and there would be a program, and then you would turn the channel and there would be another program, and then you'd kick the set and it would go like that, and then you'd turn it off, and you would obviously know, like any good scientist, that the television is producing the program because you turn it on, it goes on, you turn it off, it goes off, you turn the channel, it turns. So obviously, the television produces the program. Any idiot would know that, right? Except that when you are a little more sophisticated, you realize that's not true. The television doesn't produce the program, it just receives the program from somewhere else and it puts it into that form of where you can see it. So the question is that the case with consciousness? Is consciousness some sort of fact of the universe? Does it pervade the universe? And do we, to survive and thrive, parcel out a little bit of it through the brain stem and then the middle and the top of our brains? So are we participating, each of us, in some larger conscious process? And that's an open question, but it's a really good open question. So, that sets up what we're going to investigate in more detail this morning. But first we have to sit, otherwise we're going to stay in the middle and top of our brain for the rest of our lives and never get down in the brain stem and maybe beyond that. So I guess there's one more thing to say, which is, and I'm stealing my own thunder here for what I was going to say later, but the first portal to enlightenment is taking a step back from the usual you and realizing that you're an awareness in which the usual you is doing its usual thing. That is, when you're here, you see your personality and body doing what they normally do, but you realize you're not that. You're an awareness in which those patterns play out. So the first portal to enlightenment is realizing you're not your thoughts. Your thoughts are what your awareness habitually does. That's the first portal to enlightenment. That's as far as Michael Pollan got, because he's a beginner. Okay. Yes, he's a brilliant beginner. He wrote an unbelievably good book, but he didn't go very far in the consciousness journey. Okay. So the second portal to enlightenment is when you turn attention from this to this, not to the breathing, but to the awareness itself. When you pay attention to attention, when you're aware of awareness, when you start to ask yourself, what is this awareness with which I then apprehend the world? You become aware of awareness. You say, where does this come from? What are the properties of this awareness? And that contemplation leads you to a deeper understanding of enlightenment. So the introductory instruction for the morning is find your breathing, let yourself soften and open, and then just notice whatever is happening, thoughts, feelings, and sensations. Just be here and notice that. The more advanced instruction is after you've watched the show for a little while and realize it's the same old show, then turn your attention to attention itself. I don't mean think about attention. I mean attend to attention. Pay attention to attention. And see if you can understand something about what that is and where that comes from. It turns out that when you pay attention to attention, it doesn't have any personal qualities. It has no boundaries, it has no sense of self. The sense of self comes into being when you start thinking, that's me. It's that thought that brings the self into being. So the question is, what is this attention that issues forth the self but seems to transcend self? And that's a question for you to contemplate. And there's no pill that I can give you that gives you that answer. It's something that you have to kind of, that's the spiritual work that people do. Abraham and then Bertie, and then we got to sit, because otherwise it's just a bunch of nonsense, as they say in Zen. Abraham.
How do you know that you're paying attention to attention?
Yeah. That's a great question, and the answer is, if you know it, you don't know it. Because if you know it, then you're thinking about it. Oh, I'm paying attention to attention. You're actually thinking about attention. It's a feeling. It's a palpable feeling. The difference between thought and attention itself is something that emerges as you practice. And after a while, it becomes very clear whether you were here or here. And then the question is, how can you turn here onto here? How can you attend to attention without thinking that you're attending to attention? And the answer is you just play with that. And after a while, you're able to do that. You're able to kind of look back at the looking. I have no words to say that. It's something that you just learn to do. And it can't be rushed and you can't think it into being. You just have to practice enough. I'm sorry, if we had a supercharger for this, we would all be selling it. You know, a supercharger. As Chogyam Trungpa said, meditation is spiritual manual labor. You know, you just have to keep doing it. Vernon.
Yeah, you sort of answered my question about thought, because I thought anytime you're aware of something, somehow I feel like I'm thinking about it.
Yes,
I'm aware of it. But with meditation, when you start having a thought, your mind, all you're supposed to do is reintroduce the mantra again. You don't say, oh, I'm having this thought, what's this all about? Just bring the mantra back and let it go.
Yeah. Either the breathing or the mantra and the breathing do the same thing in a sense. Yeah. Yeah, just start your mantra again, or go to your breathing. It's not that you won't want to figure this out. It's just that at a certain point you'll realize that you can't. The root beyond thought is not thought. But this is now what Fritz Perls calls elephant shit. Let's sit, shall we? And then we'll, if you think this is elephant, maybe we'll get the Brontosaurus. We're coming to it in a little while. Okay, so let's sit for 10 minutes. In this 10 minutes, forget about what I just told you. Forget about it. All you do is you find your breathing, you let yourself soften and open, and you notice whatever's happening. And when you get sucked into it, when you get absorbed by it, you come back to your breathing, soften and open, notice. That's the whole practice. 10 minutes. In 10 minutes, it's usually not possible to pay attention to attention. There's a great deal going on that you become aware of as you relax and open up. And it takes a while for that stuff to subside. Sometimes quite a while. Sometimes a long retreat before that stuff quiets down enough. But eventually, when that stuff quiets down enough, then there's just attention, and it becomes a lot easier to attend to it because there's nothing on top of it. So don't worry that you didn't quite get enlightened in this 10-minute period. But what you do is each time you sit, even if it's for 30 seconds, you congratulate yourself because you're training your brain. There was a debate when we were coming up with this idea of mindfulness. Some people thought we just ought to call it awareness training or attention training or brain training, because that's what it is. You're just wiring in a different ability into the brain, and it's just a matter of practicing that enough so that it becomes something that you can then readily do. So every time you practice, you want to say, good, another step forward. One more way to put this is, I asked Jack Kornfield once, how come I'm not getting enlightened? I'm working so hard on it, And he said, look, it's like there's this, you're enclosed in this great concrete sculpture of yourself. And each time you do a little sitting, you take a little tiny chisel and a little tiny hammer and you make a little tiny thing in that great big thing, And you still can't see the light, right? Because there's this concrete thing enclosing you. And so you just keep on. And one day, you're going to go, and the whole thing is going to be so thin, it's just going to go.
there's going to be, and you go, oh, I see, there was progress on the way. But when you're kind of doing this, it feels like there's no progress. Another way to say this is, in the short term, this is very unspectacular. You know, you calm down. And you begin to get an occasional flash of insight or an occasional feeling of, yes, I actually heard my thought instead of being my thought. You know, but it's kind of a slow process and unspectacular. And for those of us who are raised in the 21st century with all this media, it's kind of like boring, you know. But if you persist, if you realize that there's something really profound here, and there's kind of no other way to do it, but not that I know of, okay? Then you just kind of keep doing it. And over the long haul, what happens is you notice profound changes in who and how you are. And those changes happen so subtly that you don't realize, but that when you look back and when you realize your experience now versus what it was, you go, oh my God, it's so obvious to me when I think, I can hear it, I can see it. But I remember when that was impossible, when thought was thought and there was no way out of it. And so the progress is slow but steady. And if you just kind of trust the spiritual teachers, you know, who say, look, make this progress, it's worth doing, then what will transform is how and who you are. But that will happen very gradually with some remarkable breakthroughs. There will be some aha moments for sure. But mostly it's just kind of a slow process of growth and development. Okay, so Abraham.
Yeah, do you think affirmation would help, like, you know, during the meditation, you know, you would sit there and say, I'm paying attention to my attention, and you keep repeating it to yourself. Might enforce the idea.
Yeah, because each of us is different, each of us is going to have a little different way that we meditate. And so if that seems useful to you, try it, and if it's useful, do it. And so, yeah, setting an intention or repeating to yourself occasionally, this is what I'm doing, it's very helpful in orienting you. What I would guard against, though, is spending all your time saying, I'm doing this, I'm doing this, I'm doing this, because that's just reinforcing a pattern of thought. So we have to, this is not kind of like a self-improvement program that you're kind of doing, one part of you is trying to change another part of you. This is being a different you. It's coming out of that whole process here. But yeah, occasionally a good thought, a reminder, this is what I'm doing, is extremely helpful, and we all do it. Spontaneous, across the way, hey, what are you doing? You're not kind of napping, you're supposed to be meditating here, you know? Michael.
I find it's one of the cool things about getting older is less attachment and influence of sensations, the body. As the hormones drop, the body changes, I'm less influenced. I'm less driven and controlled by my body. So I think it's a wonderful thing.
And also, one becomes less defined by body. And that's probably good preparation for the fact that you're not going to have one after a while. At least for a while. Maybe you come back. I don't know. Bernie, and then we got to move on.
Okay. One more Gloria is mentioning that our guru years ago said something about. And it was a beautiful analogy. It's like dipping the cloth. Each time you dip the cloth, it gets more color to it.
Yeah.
So it's like dipping the cloth each time we meditate, and we're getting more and more to the depth.
That's a beautiful metaphor for it. Yeah, dipping the cloth. Okay, so now I'm going to shift gears slightly to follow up last class for just a couple of minutes, and then we'll go back to considering consciousness at its most profound. So, those of you who were here last week, we heard a very erudite and nice person named Craig Chalquist talk about various topics, one of which was the importance of a relationship with the natural world for mental health. And so this shortly thereafter, Ken Sherman, emailed me an article from a paper that I don't generally read, that I probably should, but that I've never actually read, called the Wall Street Journal. I probably should have. But in any event, it was an article on... That's why I put this down. Do this deal here. So that's why the lights are off. Here we go. So there we go. It switches itself off if you don't play with it for a while, it turns out. So PPU should go off. Let's see what happens here. There it is. Okay, good. Okay, so this is the title of the article, A New Outdoor Getaway, Landscapes That Have Been Rewilded. So there's this rewilding movement happening around the world. People buy, or organizations buy up large tracts of land and then bring them back to the state they were in before we ruined them. Before human beings altered them. So one of these rewilding places is here. I don't know if you can see this, but this is a yurt on the prairie. This is the American Prairie Reserve, the APR. It's now 400,000 acres that have been rewilded. It's just like it was before there was anybody there. And you can, it's going to be supposedly 3.2 million acres is what they're aiming for. And at that point, they will be able to have large predators. There'll be grizzly bear, and there'll be wolves, and there'll be bison herds, there already are, and antelope herds, and all the stuff that used to be there before we got rid of it. And you'll be able to go, you are able now to go to the American Prairie Reserve, and for $10, you can camp in designated campgrounds, or for $125, you can have a yurt, which is a high-tech yurt. It's really beautiful. It has a refrigerator and a stove, but it has no communication media at all. They drop you off or they pick you up however many days later, and all you do is commune with nature because there ain't nothing else to do. It sounds really good to me. So this is one such place, and there are a couple of pictures that are cool here about that place, and then I'll tell you about a couple of others, and then just so you know that this is happening. There's a retreat in Lapland, same thing, out there with nothing and nobody, just nature, and this is a part of the American Prairie Reserve, a herd of bison, and there's a bison. And that's the last of the pictures. So I'll leave that one up there. It's cool. So then, it being the Wall Street Journal, it tells you about some of the places where you can go right now. And for a mere $10,000 a night or whatever, there are some really pricey places here. But you can go to some of these places in various on various continents and really have an incredible natural experience while staying quite comfortable. Some of these, they teach you stuff. And some of them, they just kind of leave you there. But this is called rewilding. Those of you who are backpackers, guess what we've been doing all these years? Rewilding. and when you walk, there's one more thing I should mention here, which is this thing down there. Let's see. Los Angeles. Shinrin-yoku, or forest bathing, practitioners have sprung up across the U.S. and Europe. Ben Page, the founder of Shinrin-yoku LA, takes people on very slow 3-hour walks through the Los Angeles Arboretum of Botanical Gardens for $37 a walk. You can go for a very slow, conscious walk. We have so many good places to do this. And what you're doing is Shinrin-yoku. Forest bathing. But the idea is, if you don't go out in nature enough, you might want to do that. It might actually have some effect on your consciousness in a good way. Just thought I'd let you know about that. Thanks, Ken.
I If I need it, I'll come back down. All right, so the question is, what is this mystical experience stuff that people report? And as I said a couple of weeks ago, people report very parallel experiences by very different means, by long prayer retreats, in near-death experiences, by ascetic practices like fasting or extreme physical exertion, sometimes spontaneously. But one way that is currently in very much in the public view is with psychedelics, because there's been a renaissance of research in the use of psychedelics, primarily as medicines to deal with things like PTSD, but also there's been some work done at Johns Hopkins with normal people, you know, people without a particular diagnosis, who are after some kind of mystical experience or greater insight. And they very often have such insights. So the question is, there's no thoughts in the pill. So whatever the pill does, or whatever the mushroom does, or whatever the prayer does, or whatever the fasting does, it's not something from that. That's an agent that helps the brain work in a different way. So the question is this way valid that the brain works in, or is this just a universal human delusion for various reasons? And that's an open question. But let's look at some of what people say who have these kinds of experiences. What I'm doing is just reading a little bit from Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, which is a very well-researched book, if nothing else. Well, and more, it's more than that. But so let me get this.
Okay, so again, I'm just going to read a few very brief descriptions of what people say. Who have had very recent, these are people who are psychedelically naive, they haven't had sessions before, and they go to Johns Hopkins and they, for very, either because they have a diagnosis or because they volunteer for the study that has to do with, you know, normal people, people without a diagnosis, they get to have a guided psilocybin session. And the question is, what happens? So Karen Sokol, a life coach and energy healer in her 50s, described an experience, quote, that changed everything and opened me profoundly, end quote. At the climax of her journey, she had an encounter with a god who called himself, I Am. In its presence, she recalled, quote, every one of my chakras was exploding. And then there was this light. It was the pure light of love and divinity. And it was with me, and no words were needed. I was in the presence of this absolute, pure, divine love, and I was merging with it in this explosion of energy. Just talking about it, my fingers are getting electric. It sort of penetrated me. The core of our being, I now knew, is love. At the peak of the experience, I was literally holding the face of Osama bin Laden, looking into his eyes, feeling pure love from him and giving it to him. The core is not evil, it is love. I had the same experience with Hitler and then with someone from North Korea. So I think we are divine. This is not intellectual, this is a core knowingness, end quote. I asked, so then Pollan is talking. I asked several of my neighbors so sure this wasn't a dream or a drug-induced fantasy. A suggestion that proved no match for her noetic sense. Quote, this was no dream. This was as real as you and I having this conversation. I wouldn't have understood it either if I hadn't had the direct experience. Now it is hardwired in my brain so I can connect to it, and I do so often, end quote. So the question is why, you know, this experience is what she's describing is what's parallel to mystic experience throughout history. That's what people say, you know, in so many different cultures. Why do we have this? Is it what you know, it's not a normal experience? What good, you know, why does the brain have this capacity? Or if this is a delusion, why did it, it's not a
something.
Somebody's
phone needs oil and
they
know it. Oh, is that a phone?
Yeah.
Good. I hoped it wasn't something.
Why do we have it? Because it wouldn't seem to be useful. I mean, it's not something that is ordinarily had. So why would it have evolved? Because it doesn't give us any survival appropriation advantage. Because almost nobody has such an experience. What good is it?
Well, actually, you might ask the opposite. Why do we have it all the time?
If the question is, why don't we have it all the time? That's a question that presupposes that there's something real that exists that we're not tuned into. And of course, we'll talk about that. Why the brain is a reducing valve, and why the brain in its reducing has reduced something so important for human thriving.
I mean, as I understand it, the Buddha claimed that he was able to have that all the time while still functioning.
Oh, many people say that. Once they've had this experience, it never totally goes away. It underlies they live on two levels. They live on the level of spirit, and they live on the level of manifestation. And you know, that's why people walk around with prayer beads, and to remind them of this experience, which is a continual part of their life. But most of us haven't had such experience. The question is this just a delusion that helps them to navigate life without anxiety, or is this something real? But we'll go further. Okay, so Ken.
Is it fair to ask if anyone in this room had such an experience?
I don't want to have that show of hands, but I know that
why not?
I don't want to. I found out last night and thought, individuals can volunteer when we talk, when we have discussion. But I don't want people to kind of be put on the spot about did you or didn't you have a mystic experience. It's just something that feels too private about that. Also, many of us would be raising half a hand, kind of, Chris. It seems so at the time. Okay, another description. Oh, so Michael Pollan in the book How to Change Your Mind does is he makes reference to William James' typology of mystic experience. Now, William James was a Harvard psychologist who worked about 120 years ago, about 1900, and wrote a book called The Varieties of Religious Experience, which is not only still used as a textbook in comparative religion classes, but is what Michael Pollan referred to when describing the aspects of mystic experience. So whatever William James did way back then still rings very true. So the fourth and last mark in James's typology is the essential passivity of the mystical experience. Quote, this is William James. The mystic feels as if his own will, maybe I'll translate this into the 21st century. The mystic feels as if her own will were in abeyance, and indeed sometimes as if she were grasped and held by a superior power, end quote. This sense of having temporarily surrendered to a superior force often leaves a person feeling as if he or she had been permanently transformed. For most of the Hopkins volunteers I interviewed, their psilocybin journeys had taken place 10 or 15 years earlier, and yet their effects, yet the effects were still keenly felt, in some cases on a daily basis. Quote, psilocybin awakened my loving compassion and gratitude in a way I had never experienced before, end quote. The psychologist who asked me to not be named told me when I asked her about its lasting effects. Quote, trust, letting go, openness, and being. Trust, letting go, openness, and being were the touchstones of the experience for me. Now I know these things instead of just believing, end quote. She had turned Bill Richards' flight instructions into a manual for living. Bill Richards is a prominent psychedelic researcher. Richard Boothby, who was a philosophy professor in his 50s, did the same thing, converting his insights about letting go into a kind of ethic. This is Boothby talking. During my session, this art of relaxation itself became the basis of an immense revelation. As it suddenly appeared to me that something in the spirit of this relaxation, something in the achievement of a perfect, trusting, and loving openness of spirit, is the very essence and purpose of life. Our task in life consists precisely in a form of letting go of fear and expectations, an attempt to purely give oneself to the impact of the present. John Hayes, a psychotherapist, emerged with his, quote, sense of the concrete destabilized, replaced by a conviction, quote, that there's a reality, this is John Hayes, there's a reality beneath the reality of ordinary perceptions. It informed my cosmology that there is a world beyond this one, end quote. Hayes particularly recommends the experience to people in middle age, for whom, as Carl Jung suggested, the experience of the numinous can help them negotiate the second half of their lives. Hayes added, end quote, begin quote, I would not recommend it to young people, end quote. The reason for that is because this is an experience of letting go of ego, of destroying ego, at least temporarily. Young people are still building a secure ego. And if you don't have a secure ego built and you kind of crumble it, it can have deleterious later effects. You haven't built what you need to move through life. There's a lot of implication of that for who did what when and who should have done what when. Or not done what when. Okay. So, now we're going to get to one of Michael Pollan's experiences. Again, this is a very bright and well put together human being, turning 60, who is not psychedelically experienced and is not a really very religious person, not at all a spiritual religious person, very scientific kind of person, who had six journeys total on various substances. So he takes a lot of implication from these six journeys because he's so smart and because he's mature. But six journeys is tipping your cup in the water. So there's a lot that he didn't experience and doesn't incorporate in his worldview yet. But let's see what he does incorporate. This is, in fact, his main point of the book, okay? That this kind of experience is really important in personal and spiritual growth. And I agree, but it's a beginning experience, profound though it is. Okay, so, when I put my eye shades back on and lay down, I was disappointed to find myself back in computer world. That is, his visions are of a technological world. But something had changed, no doubt the result of the stepped-up dose. He took a booster dose of psilocybin.
of course, this is in a very guided setting with a lot of preparation and debriefing. Yeah, this isn't somebody at a party or alone. This is somebody that is has been well prepared and is well taken care of. Whereas before I navigated this landscape as myself, taking in the scene from a perspective recognizable as my own, I'm in a computer world, with my attitudes intact, highly critical of the music, coming, oh, he's got eye shades on and earphones, he's lying down, so he's highly critical of the music, for instance, and anxious about what demons might appear, that's himself before the booster dose. Now I watched as that familiar self began to fall apart before my eyes, gradually at first and then all at once. I, the sense of self, now turned into a sheaf of little papers, no bigger than post-its, and they were being scattered to the wind. But the I taking in this seeming catastrophe, the I looking at this scattering of the I, had no desire to chase after the slips and pile my old self back together. No desires of any kind, in fact. Whoever I now was fine with whatever happened. No more ego? That was okay. In fact, the most natural thing in the world. And then I looked and saw myself out there again, but this time spread over the landscape like paint or butter, thinly coating a wide expanse of the world with a substance I recognized as me. But so this is the brain symbolizing an experience. That's what the brain does. It makes pictures and words to symbolize experience. But the question is, what is this experience of the self not being, of two selves, of a me that is not me, watching the me that formerly was being dissolved? But who was this I that was able to take in the scene of its own dissolution? Good question. It wasn't me exactly. Here the limits of our language become a problem. In order to completely make sense of the divide that had opened up in my perspective, I would need a whole new first-person pronoun. For what was observing the scene, the one watching, was a vantage and a mode of awareness entirely distinct from my accustomed self. In fact, I hesitate to use the word I to denote the presiding awareness. It was so different from my usual first person. Where that self had always been a subject enclosed in this body, where the usual me had always been a subject encapsulated in a body, this one, this me, seemed unbounded by anybody, even though I now had access to its perspective. There's still something looking, but it doesn't seem to be bound into that perspective that is using. That perspective, the one that's watching, was supremely indifferent, neutral on all questions of interpretation, and unperturbed even in the face of what by all rights should have been an unmitigated personal disaster. Yet the personal had been obliterated. Everything I once was and called me, this six decades in the making, had been liquefied and dispersed over the scene. What had always been a thinking, feeling, perceiving subject based in here was now an object out there. I was paint. Let me stop for a minute and go back to this diagram, and then we'll go back to his explanation. This sounds really far out, weird, wonderful, and horrible, and you know. But in fact, you all experienced this. Probably experienced it this morning. This is me, subject, enclosed, skin encapsulating ego, right? That's what Alan Watts called it. This is me, the usual me. But every time you find your breathing, and for a moment you notice the thought, you can't be the thought to notice it. You took a step back, and you become a perspective in which there is thought. So every time you're here, you're the one watching the one out here, just like he did. And meditators who are quite experienced spend a lot of time here watching the paint or watching the post-its.
Understand, this is not so far out. This is something that many of you experience routinely. He just experienced it very dramatically. The psychedelics make everything very dramatic. But it's something that you're learning to do so that you have two perspectives. The question then is, what is this? If it isn't personal and it doesn't really get all upset about the drama anymore and doesn't really identify with the body anymore, that's what he has to say. The one on the left there, this one, close by me, is the ego, what we call the ego, the sense of self, the usual sense of self. The sovereign ego, with all its armaments and fears, that's what ego is, it's all its defenses and fears and desires and all that kind of stuff that we usually think of as us. The sovereign ego, with all its armaments and fears, its backward-looking resentments and forward-looking worries, was simply no more. And there was no one left to mourn its passing. Yet something had succeeded it, this bare, disembodied awareness, which gazed upon the scene of the self's dissolution with benign indifference. I was present to reality, but as something other than myself. And although there was no self left to feel exactly, there was a feeling tone, which was calm, unburdened, and content. There was life after the death of the ego. This was big news. A little more. When I think back on this part of the experience, I've occasionally wondered if this enduring awareness might have been the, quote, mind at large that Aldous Huxley described during his Mescaline trip in 1953. Huxley never quite defined what he meant by the term, except to speak of, quote, the totality of the awareness belonging to capital M mind at capital L large. But he seemed to be describing a universal, shareable form of consciousness unbounded by any single brain. Others have called it cosmic consciousness, the oversoul, or universal mind. This is supposed to exist outside our brains, as a property of the universe, like light or gravity, and just as pervasive, constitutive to certain individuals at certain points, gain access to this awareness, allowing them to perceive reality in its perfected light, at least for a time. Just a little more, and then I'll comment. Nothing in my experience led me to believe this novel form of consciousness originated, nothing in my, now this is where Michael Pollan is still, he's had an initial experience of ego death, of not being the self that he formerly identified with. But an initial experience is not a complete mystical experience, it's just a, what they call a kensho, a first glimpse of enlightenment. So you come back to your usual ego functioning. You haven't left it permanently or for any length. So you try to interpret what you experience from the point of view of your ego. Your ego keeps trying to make sense of the world in its former way. Okay? Those of you who've read or heard Eckhart Tolle, he talks about this all the time, about how the ego is going to kind of try to stay in control by thinking and trying to put it together. So this is what he's going to say now. Okay. Nothing in my experience led me to believe this novel form of consciousness originated outside me. It seems just as plausible and surely more parsimonious to assume it was a product of my brain, just like the ego it supplanted. Yet this by itself strikes me as a remarkable gift, that we can let go of so much, the desires, fears, and defenses of a lifetime, without suffering complete annihilation. This might not come as a surprise to Buddhists, transcendentalists, or experienced meditators, but it was sure news to me, who had never felt anything but identical to my ego. Could it be there's another ground on which to plant our feet? For the first, for the first time since embarking on this project, I began to understand what the volunteers in the cancer anxiety trials have been trying to tell me. How it was that a psychedelic journey had granted them a perspective from which the very worst in life, from which the very worst life could throw at us, up to and including death, could be regarded objectively and accepted with equanimity. So, what he's saying is this perspective, even if the brain originates it, allows us to be much freer from our fears and concerns than the usual way we walk around. Now, the big question is this a product of the brainstem, or is this something the brainstem is receiving from outside? And he's going to argue throughout the book that he just kind of can't go there, that it's something outside him. We'll look at, probably not now, but as time goes on, we'll look at other descriptions of people who had experiences like this, where they're more and more convinced that this isn't something that they're generating, it's something they're receiving. What is physics? Now, Orthodox science doesn't like this very much, but what does physics say about that? This these days? Physics is inching toward, and I mean inching, a point of view that has to include consciousness as a primary component of reality. For example, many of you know about the understanding, actually James Hartle came and talked to our class one time, an originator of the Hartle-Hawking wave function of the universe. That was a class when the microphone wasn't on, so most of us couldn't hear him. But what he was saying, he's a UCSB professor, and with he and Stephen Hawking came up with this idea that... if you want to hear James Hartle, who's worth hearing, and if you couldn't hear him, if that's on, that's fantastic. So you can actually hear James Hartle talking to us about the universe. So what they say is, the universe is a probability function, and it's by observing that you take one of these possibilities and you reify it. So there's something about the your consciousness that is integral in the structure of the universe. Now, I probably said that in a way that any physicist would be horrified by, but I'm doing the best I can with that. It's a hard understanding. But the understanding is, more and more physicists are realizing that you can't separate out the observing of the universe from the universe. They seem to be joined together in some critical way, so much that far-out physicists are saying, not only are they joined together, but the structure of the universe itself includes consciousness as its one of its properties, and what mystics say is as its fundamental property. Mystics say, out of consciousness come the properties that define the universe. That the void, shunyata, the pregnant void, gives birth to the phenomenon, the set of phenomena we call universe. This is what the mystics say. Now, they may be like crazy, but they may also be have an incredibly profound insight. Let's go a little further, shall we? Let's just go a little further. Yeah, I think so. What I have is I have Michael Pollan's given some interviews since he wrote this book, and he's very good to hear. And so I excerpted one of his interviews, and I was going to play it for you today, but I think I'll play it for you at the next session, because I want to go a little further with our argument today, if that's okay. This is a lot of words, but I think that they're kind of all hangs together. Amy.
Michael Pollan, if you don't know, is going to speak this season at the UCSB Department of the Arts and Lectures. So you can go hear him talk about this.
Yeah, when is he coming?
I don't know.
I think maybe in the spring, is that right? Do I remember? So anyway, Michael Pollan's going to be at UCSB Arts and Lectures, and you probably ought to get tickets for that because it's a Campbell Hall, so it'll sell out, I would guess. Bernie.
Is it, you know, as you're speaking, is it possible that these are people are just tapping into a huge revolution that we're moving towards to become like that in the future as a natural state for everybody.
That's what the presumption of a lot of people is. It's, this is a level of awareness that we are growing into, and that this will transform the way that we treat one another and we treat our lives. And what some people in the 60s thought is, if enough people have this kind of experience, it will create peace and love and a different world. And some of those people are now universally vilified, but I have to say a few good words for Tim. As in Tim Leary. Every psychedelic, Michael Pollan says that every researcher he talked to says it's too much to blame what happened, the folding down of all this research on Tim Leary. And then they go right ahead and they blame Tim Leary. But what he was saying is this experience would not only transform individuals, it would transform society. But that's what people who have had mystic experiences have said. That's what Paul said on the road to madness. That's what Buddha said. That's what Lao Tzu said. You know, if people had this experience, they'd understand things differently. They treat one another differently. They treat life on Earth differently. They treat life differently. You know what I'm going to do? I think I'm going to show you a little bit of the Michael Pollan interview. And then next week, I'll do a little more reading so they don't have to keep reading and reading. And then a little bit more of the Michael Pollan interview. Okay? So this is enough words. Let's do a little Michael Pollan. And then I'll break it into two parts. And then next week, we'll do a little more Michael Pollan. I'll do a little more of the reading. What I want you to understand is, even though he's going to be talking about the research with psychedelics, that's not my primary interest. My primary interest is consciousness. And what he's pointing to using the vehicle of psychedelics is something beyond psychedelics. It's something about consciousness. So I will probably stop the interview at various points and say, what other ways can we look at this? Or what other routes are there to get these kind of experiences? Okay, so here we go. You know, yeah, I think those, yeah, let's close them. Let's maybe leave these ones open, but close these and those, just so we get a really nice view. And if maybe we'll have to close those too, but let's do it. It's worth it. It's worth it to do it. I think we can't not have some light. I'll leave some of these lights on. So I want to go to Secondary's Cultures, cspan.org. I'm going to my campus email, and so you kind of can't see that because there's a lot of stuff from students. So that's why I put the mute up there. Let's find this.
Yeah.
Okay, wait, so let me get this upper. I don't know, but I'll put that off and then put that on. Nope. Is that good enough for you? Okay. How's that, Robert? Is that okay?
Works for me.
What?
Yeah, it's okay for me.
Okay, good, okay, good. All right, so here we go. So, I need to get us to, let's start here and I'll go to where I'm going to. What's this? Yeah. So, I gotta get us to where I'm gonna start at. 31.
Yeah. I think the 60s might have been a CIA.
Okay, so. So, this is Michael Pollan being interviewed at a temple in Washington, D.C. earlier this year. His interviewer, the person interviewing him, is Alex Spiegel of NPR. ALIX NPR. Is her name. What?
What's NPR?
National Public Radio.
Oh.
And so she's going to be questioning him. So I'm going to start it halfway through. If you want to see this, you go to c-span.org. C-span.org. And you... put Pollan in the search bar and up will come this video. I'm only going to show you the second half of the video. And again, only maybe 15 minutes of it today and 15 minutes of it next time. So here goes.
CIA mind control experiment gone really bad or good, depending on your perspective.
That's funny. But I mean, because you write in your book that like every culture that has tried to kind of shutter these drugs. And so that made me think, is there something inherent in the drugs that's dangerous or that's threatening? And so will that be the inevitable result?
Yeah, because it happened once. Because it was threatening then doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be threatening now, and I'll explain why. I mean, many cultures have been threatened by psychedelic drugs. Think about when the Spanish get to Mexico, they conquer Mexico, and there are these mushroom cults. And the Indians there are using mushrooms, psilocybin mushrooms, as their sacrament, and they call it Tionatacal, which means flesh of the gods. Gee, just like the Catholic sacrament, right? I mean, you've got the blood and the body of Christ. But the problem is, the Indian sacrament is so much better because you don't need faith. You actually see God, you know? And the Spanish couldn't allow that to happen. That was a huge threat to the church. So they crushed it. And for 500 years, these mushroom cults went underground until the 50s. So, to certain kinds of authority, that direct access is hugely threatening. And, you know... And
I mean, is it fundamentally destabilizing? Like, you said all these researchers, you feel underneath underneath their scientific facade, like, a yearning. So
part of me feels that there's something fundamental to the drugs that will be challenging. I mean, that they do cause many people... See, my reluctance is I hate to generalize about it because the effect can be so variable and so dependent on context. So it's easy to imagine a context where they're not destabilizing. But anyway, in the 60s, I'll give you an example of why they were so destabilizing then, but why that won't happen again.
Okay.
And this is, but we're in the realm of speculation, right? Except, well, history and then speculation. So in the 60s, I think what was really destabilizing about LSD and psilocybin is that it was giving the youth culture an experience that adult culture didn't have. So you had this, it was a rite of passage
for people. I mean, it was like a conversion experience. People who, you know, you were experienced or you weren't experienced, as Jimi Hendrix famously said. And, but most rites of passage in all cultures are designed by the elders to conduct the adolescents into the adult world, whether you're talking about a bar mitzvah, a vision quest, whatever it is. The rules are set by the adults, the kids do it, and when they complete the assignment, they are adults. Here you have the kids were organizing their own rite of passage, and they ended up in a place that adults were completely unfamiliar with. That can only happen once, because now the adults have had experience. You know, in large numbers, many people in charge in our society have had a psychedelic experience, so that I don't think they'll ever be quite as threatened as, say, my parents were in the 60s, and Richard Nixon was in the 60s.
If you had to guess, would you guess that it, if I asked you now to guess whether or not it will get shut down again,
yeah.
What would you say?
I would say no. Yeah, I think Rick Doblin, who's one of the key movers and shakers in this research, he has an organization called the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, known as MAPS. He makes the point that, and this he credits to Leary, that Leary turned on so many people with his antics and his, you know, turn on, tune in, drop out, that we now have a culture that can accept psychedelics. In other words, he infected enough people that you're not going to have the same kind of reaction. And he also points out that so many other social or cultural or aesthetic innovations of the 60s we take for granted. You know, that in the 60s, there was not yoga. There was not natural childbirth. There was not hospice care. I mean, all these innovations, you know, we've gotten used to, and he thinks now we can get used to this.
So
whether he's right or not, I don't know. But it's an interesting case.
But your guess is we can get used to it, and
unless
it goes down
unless people
today,
really fuck up,
then it went down before.
It doesn't have to go down the same way because you don't have the situation where you have, you know, a generation gap, that you have a split. I mean, we never had such a in American history, a situation where the young had a different culture than the old. We don't have it now. You know, we can listen to our kids' music, they can listen to our music.
Yeah,
we all wear blue jeans. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's just more continuity now. I mean, it was really a sharp break, and LSD has something to do with that break.
Okay.
And so, yeah, so I'm guardedly optimistic.
You're guardedly optimistic. Which brings us to the Renaissance and what it wants to accomplish. Why don't you start by, let me just ask, so do you think, so all of these drugs did get a really bad name in the 60s and they were seen as dangerous, and I got the sense that you really feel like that was wholly unwarranted. Do you feel like that is wholly unwarranted?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's important to talk about risk. Because things go wrong, you know, and there were a lot of horror stories in the 60s. Many of them were urban legends, you know, the one about people, kids staring at the sun until they go blind. I remember hearing that one when I was in high school. That was completely made up. The commissioner of the blind for the state of Washington wanted to discourage kids from using LSD, so he said, oh, this story will do it.
And it worked.
Boom. I still run into people who believe it, and there are all these urban legends. But Art Linkletter's daughter jumped out of a window, and he blamed LSD and campaigned against it, which helped drive the drug war. Was that true? Was that really about LSD? We don't know. I mean, there's no evidence of it. That's what he believed. It's important to understand that there are risks associated with these drugs. You are destabilized. Your defenses are down. You're incapacitated, you know, on a high dose. And people do stupid things under those circumstances. They walk out into traffic. They fall out of buildings. That's going to happen. There are risks. Other people have terrifying experiences. Some of which go under the rubric bad trip. But a handful of them go under the rubric of psychotic episodes. People at risk for mental illness, schizophrenia, say? I mean, if they have a predisposition or family, you know, family history of it, they need to stay away from these drugs, and they're not allowed in these trials, which are very carefully, they carefully select people. We don't know that psychedelics have ever caused a serious mental illness in people, or were, you know, that someone who wasn't at risk for it, but it's possible. So the risks are psychological. They're not, oddly enough, they're not physiological. I was nervous, Nelly, about this, and really check things out.
Okay, so I have to make a point about this, not only about psychedelics, but about mystic experience in general. These are weird experiences. The question is, what happens to people who have mystic experiences? What happens to Buddha? What happens to Lao Tzu? What happens to Paul on the road? You know, what happens to these people that have experiences of seeing some greater reality? And the answer the answer in general is they don't get worse, they get better. Okay, that is, when we look at what happens to the people who are having terminal diagnoses and who are in the Hopkins trial, and they're faced with their own death, their own mortality, and they have these psilocybin experiences, they come out better. They come out feeling better. More accepting, more able to deal with their family in a constructive way. So something about the destabilizing that happens, the opening that happens when it gets integrated, when it comes back together, creates a positive rather than a negative effect. Not kids at parties necessarily, you know, but all these substances, all these technologies, never mind the substances, all these technologies are used in various cultures in very ritualized, tested, socially supported ways. People don't go out there and do this stuff by themselves. They go, they're prepared, their culture is part of that process, they're guided, they're supported, and then the integration happens with great participation from other people. So it's a very different, it's a very powerful kind of thing. It's not dangerous if it's used in a constructive way, but if it's used in a cavalier kind of way, sure, it can be dangerous. Dynamite can be used to, you know, make holes in mountains for tunnels. It could also be used to blow people up. It depends on what what you're going to use it for and how you're going to, you know, approach it. So the question about these experiences is, yes, they are they shatter the usual perspective, but does that then lead to worse outcome or better outcome? Schizophrenic breaks lead to worse outcome. Psychotic breaks lead to worse outcome. But though some people say even schizophrenia, if supported well enough, can turn out to be a positive experience. R.D. Lang, who actually came to Santa Barbara many years ago and talked about this, said that in those places that he used to run, where people having schizophrenic episodes were got 24-hour care and amazing amount of support, they actually came through schizophrenic episode. That's what he said. I don't know, that research is hard to do, so that's just kind of an intimation of what might happen. But even schizophrenia might, when it's supported, have a better outcome. I do know that our culture does the worst with schizophrenics. That is, other cultures which are more tolerant of deviance actually support people that we would call schizophrenic, and they do fine in the culture. They're different, but not ostracized. So our culture, if you're schizophrenic, get out of our culture. So the point about these experiences is they're very discontinuous with a normal kind of experience. That doesn't make them injurious. What makes them either helpful or hurtful is the setting that they are done in. Okay. We're not going to see the section of this where he says, "Look, if you're going to do something like this, you do it with a very good guide, with a very good preparation and very good support." Unfortunately, you still have to do it, unless you're in one of these clinical trials, you have to do it underground in our culture, which puts a stigma, and you're doing something illegal. You know, that's not a good vibe to go into a any kind of session with. It would be nice if the culture would support it. And of course, there are areas where the culture does not make it illegal. For example, the Native American church, you know, and in Brazil, the ayahuasca churches, you know, there the culture supports those. And so people have better outcomes than when they feel like they're doing something criminal. We'll go a little more with this. One more thing. I guess what I'm saying here, because most of us are not going to go out and do this. What the argument underneath this is as you meditate or as you pray or as you do whatever you do to kind of open up as a person, allow yourself to open up. Don't be afraid about that. If you're doing it gradually, if you're doing it with a good intention, if you're doing it in a good setting, then probably you can open up a little further than you did before without paying a negative price, but rather you gain from that. So there's a bravery. Whenever I sit down and meditate, it's like a new experience. And what's going to happen is going to happen. And I have to have a trust that I'm doing it in a way that has, I'm intending to grow and be a better person. And so when it comes to the point of, can I let go of that feeling? Or can I think that thought? Or can I have that sensory experience? Why not? And so that you can do this very gradually, kind of open your ego or loosen the bonds of your ego. But you do that with a trust that doing it in the way that you're doing it will lead to a growth rather than a retrenchment of some kind. So you don't have to do psilocybin, but when you sit and meditate, what you're doing is essentially the same thing. You're saying, I would like to be a little more open and learn a little more.
Carefully before I did this, but they're remarkably non-toxic. There's a lethal dose of Advil. I don't know what it is, or Tylenol. I mean, lots of over-the-counter drugs have lethal doses, and there is no known lethal dose for the classic psychedelics. And they're non-addictive. They're not habit-forming. Your first thought when you have completed a psychedelic journey is like, where do I get some more? It's like, do I ever have to do that again?
All right, so let's turn to the Renaissance and briefly, how it got started, and what are they trying to accomplish, and how they are trying to accomplish it.
There's not one they. There's a couple.
Okay, so we're at 40. Okay, so we stopped at 40. So I think I want to stop because I want to see if there's a comment or two, and so this is going to be a whole kind of next section. So let me put on the lights. Abracadabra, maybe. There you go. If we pull those things open, we can maybe have a comment or two about this. Again, the
reason I'm using pollen is because he's so much in the public eye right now. But this is just one way of looking at the central question of who we are and what our consciousness is. So it's not for me so much about psychedelics as it is about what our mind is. And this is just one window, but it's kind of a very currently, the cultural conversation is informed a lot by this particular man and this particular research program. Okay, so comment or question? Okay, Abraham first.
Yeah, I would recall, like the near death experience for these people that have gone through it, it has illuminated them and made them come back, looking at life with a different perspective. Seeing that tunnel going through the light and coming back and reflect on that has actually enhanced their connection with the spirit, their spirituality.
Yeah.
And I know that, you know, some of the people that used LSDs, especially in the 60s, because I was here in the 60s, have gone through the same experience. But when they came back, they were depressed.
I don't know about that.
This is my personal experience with the people that I've been.
Colin didn't get there yet, okay. But after the experience that you have of your ego loosening, there's much more to be experienced. And whether you have a near-death experience or whether you have a deep psychedelic experience, there's often this feeling of moving through the tunnel to the light, and then being reborn, coming back. I'll talk about that later. I'm actually going to read some descriptions of that kind of experience in a little while. The depression part, I mean, I don't know. But I know that this was part of, when psychedelic therapy was legal, these kinds of experiences were part of the healing process that people with very deep difficulties went through. But I'll speak more about that later. So we'll table the...
A famous example is John Lennon.
Who got depressed?
Yes.
Maybe he was dealing with depression in general, and it was episodic. Okay, I guess we gotta... I'm sorry, I didn't realize it was over time. So I guess we have to break for today. We'll come back to this topic at least for a while next week. I want to tell you that I'm not going to spend the whole time up in the clouds. There's some very down-to-earth stuff that I need to present to you. It might be a week or so before it gets here, but if this is a little ethereal for you, then we're coming back to the nitty-gritty soon. Okay. Have a great week. See you next week.